Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia. Måske så er du på vej ud at købe ind, når du lytter til den her podcast. Men du kan godt stoppe op, fordi du behøver slet ikke gå ned i supermarkedet og købe ind mere, fordi nu er der et finsk firma, nogle finske forskere, der har fundet ud af, hvordan du kan lave mad af den rene luft. Firmaet hedder Solar Foods, og dem kan du møde lige om lidt. Du kan også overveje, om du skal kommunikere med fisk ved hjælp af lys, som et britisk forskningsprojekt gør, for at forhindre overfiskning. Og når du så kigger ned ad dig selv, kan du så overveje, om du skal have noget nyt tøj her, hvor efterårssæsonen den står for døren. Og når du gør det, så kan du så overveje, om de næste skjorte eller kjole skal designes af en bakterie frem for et menneske. Se, det er nogle af de designidéer, du kan møde i dagens udgave af Tektopia, som netop handler om, hvordan design kan forbedre vores liv, vores forhold til planeten og gøre noget godt for miljøet og dyrelivet og naturen osv. Hver andet år så uddeler folkene bag The Index Project en pris, eller rettere sagt, de uddeler faktisk 5 priser. The Index Award Designed to Improve Your Life. De 5 priser blev faktisk uddelt i fredags den 6. september, og du kan møde 3 af vinderne i den her udgave af Tektopia. Jeg skulle måske lige sige, at missionen for den internationale designpris Index Award, som i øvrigt er hjemme her i København, ja, den har siden 2005 været at uddele priser til design og teknologi, som gør livet bedre for mange. Vi tænker altså ikke på smukke stole eller smukke lamper, men på designløsninger, som kan give højere livskvalitet og nye muligheder for verdens fattigste. I dag kan du så møde 3 af de 5 vindere fra årets pris. Det er jo altid svært at vælge, hvor man skal begynde, når man står med 3 ret banebrydende og måske næsten på papiret i hvert fald lidt vanvittige idéer. Men jeg tror, at den, der rykkede mest ved mit hoved, det var det finske projekt Solar Foods, der påstår, at de kan lave mad af den rene luft. Så lad os stille om til Finland og høre om verdens første fabrik, der kan lave mad af den rene luft. Det er projektet Solar Foods.
Jeg er Pasi Vainikka, I'm CEO of Solar Foods. My background is in our National Research Institute in VTT Finland, and together with Juha-Pekka Pitkänen, our CTO, we then came together at the research institute and came up with the concept and idea for producing a new food. Making food from electricity and air is technically it's gas fermentation. So if we look at classical sugar-based fermentation when making beer or wine, you have an agricultural product in a liquid, for example, grapes or some that contains sugars. You have a sugars liquid and you put in yeast to it. And these yeasts in breweries happen to be such that they grow and make alcohol to the liquid that is surrounding them by using sugar, the sugar as a source of energy and carbon. So they eat sugar. Instead of that, we use small bubbles of hydrogen that contain energy and carbon dioxide that are introduced into the fermenter. So instead of sugars, our microbe eats dissolved hydrogen and carbon dioxide for energy and carbon. And that's where the disconnection from agriculture happens and how this differentiates from everything what we've had so far. Then in this liquid, the microbes grow and multiply. We continuously supply these ingredients in, also some nutrients, a bit of salts for that all the forms of life need. The microbes grow and multiply. You continuously take the liquid out and dry it, and you end up with a powder that is about 65% protein.
So the end product is a powder. What can you use this powder for?
There are three segments that we want to highlight. One is existing foodstuff. That means bread, pasta, or similar. It means those products that are plant-based today, for example, different kinds of drinks, whether or they are soy or oat or almond-based or plant-based dairy, yogurts, and similar. So we could be a protein ingredient in this segment, existing plant-based foodstuff. The second category that seems to be increasing fast is plant-based meat alternatives. Usually it helps a lot to say beyond meat or impossible. These are one of the well-known plant-based meat alternatives. When these are made, they need proteins, soy or pea proteins these days. So we could actually supply protein into this. And the third sector or segment is cultured meat. So if cultured meat would be technically the route to take, so make real meat cells, that's also a fermentation process where you grow these cells. And these cells, when they grow, they eat sugar and amino acids. So the question is that if that scales, where do the amino acids come from? And they could come from our proteins. So by describing these three, you can actually find that instead of just producing a powder, we can be part of existing and future foods in a quite diverse way and see our technology as a platform technology to disconnect proteins from agriculture.
The production of this protein, how expensive is it?
The production cost for the first full-scale factory that we just finished the pre-engineering design of, and I think we're going to publish something about that later in the autumn. We are talking about in the order of five, six, around €5, $6 per kilogram on 100% protein basis. So that is twice or three times more expensive than soy is. But on the other hand, we are close to match the protein price and ingredients in those segments what we aim at. So it's surprisingly cost competitive.
And when you scale it, will it become cheaper?
We think that the floor cost could be around €2 per kilogram on 100% protein basis. It is highly dependent on the price of electricity. And the reason why we are going down this route is actually the very fundamental and strategic view that the cost of generation for electricity actually is decreasing. Meanwhile, whatever we've done in the food sector, the cheapest source of power are these days.
Could you explain to us this institute that you work for? What is it? What do you do there? What kind of research do you do?
Yeah, this is VTT is the acronym, so that's the from the Finnish wordings for Technical Research Center of Finland, our public research institute. It's something similar to Fraunhofer in Germany or NREL in the US. It works under the kind of mandate of ministry for trade and employment.
So you were sitting there at the institute and you discovered a problem that you want to solve. What kind of problem was it that you wanted to solve?
To the demand and how it goes. But the first full-scale factory that we are designing would already, this one factory, provide about 6% of the plant-based proteins that are eaten in Finland. So you can actually introduce relatively large quantities quickly once you scale it, but of course we have a route to take until we are at that point. We would be part of a healthy diet. We could capture some share of the protein market in the future, and we don't expect people to change really what they require from the food, meaning how it tastes and how what is the mouth feeling. So let's see.
Now you mentioned the taste. What does it taste like? I assume it doesn't taste like anything, but it has to be mixed with something else to have a taste.
It is correct that we aim at a neutral taste, which means no taste. And the current organism, what seems to be the most likely one that we are going to permit for the food application, it has a bit of umami taste, so it's kind of an enriching, a bit kind of a meaty taste, but hardly any, quite neutral, that is something what we aim at. So whether it's in ice cream or in pancakes or in plant-based meat alternative, in for example, if you imagine a lasagna, if we can be in the pasta or in the sauce or in the plant-based meat alternative, there in the meaty part. So we aim at to be of diverse use.
I noticed from the homepage that that you also have a cooperation with the European Space Agency.
Yes, that is quite interesting. So the Mars mission is something what is there kind of in the 2030s in the books of ESA and NASA, and why not the Chinese, Indians, or Roscosmos in Russia, and the food, the issue of food is unresolved. So currently in the close to Earth, in the orbital systems, you go with packed food. So you shoot packed food to the space, but when you go to Mars, then the shelf life might need to be up to 7 years. And today it doesn't work. So they are looking at options how to produce food at the destination. And we have promised to make some initial feasibility study on if this process could work. And actually, we're just about to finish the study, and it seems that it actually really could work. And now let's see if we can continue with ESA this project next year to actually look at the some of the specific issues related to space.
So what you're aiming to do is to put a solar food factory on Mars.
Yes.
Whoa. And the process can actually work in an environment like the one that you have on Mars.
On paper and on concept level, yes. If there is some technical detail that has to do with separation, or not having gravity, you're in zero gravity, that there might be a specific issue in separation. There's something that we might need to troubleshoot, but then you just change some elements of the process. But it, you know, why not?
That's amazing. Can I ask you one last question? When or where is it possible to try this product? I mean, if you're already producing 1 kilogram per day in this pilot plant, it must be possible to try it soon.
This food is so-called novel food. So actually it is illegal to sell it before you permit it for human consumption. And we are now iterating with the organism and organisms and options for them, and doing extensive analysis of various kinds, and developing the kind of the recipe how to grow it as fast as possible. So there is a lot of iteration ongoing, and once we choose, there might be actually already one that we might go for or go with an organism that we plan to take to the permitting, and for that we are generating quantities, sending those samples for analysis, and those analyses would be put together for a so-called novel food dossier. We have not submitted that yet. It needs to be done. And once you submit, then it takes about a year and a half to 2 years to get it approved for human consumption in the European Union. Therefore, we say that we would be on the market in 2021. We are just about to be capable of doing that. Let's see how it goes, or if we need to go to 22. But that's roughly the timeline, whether it's European Union or the US with FDA or whichever country.
Jeg linker til Solar Foods fra tektopia.dk. Og vi bliver lidt i madens verden, selvom det er måske lidt forkert bare at opfatte fisk som mad. Og det er i virkeligheden også lidt det projektet Pisces det handler om. Det handler nemlig om, at der bliver fanget alt for mange fisk, som bare bliver smidt ud igen, fordi de ryger med i nettet sammen til fisk, som egentlig skal bruges til fødevarer. Så projektet her det handler om at kunne kommunikere med fiskene ved hjælp af lys, så man kun fanger de fisk, man har brug for i anførselstegn. Jeg fangede en af bagmændene via Skype, hvor han stod på en havnekaj i det nordlige Frankrig. Det er derfor, der er sådan lidt havmåger i baggrunden.
My name is Dan Watson. I'm the CEO and the founder of Safety Net Technologies. We work with commercial fishing groups and fishing operations to create technologies to help make fishing more sustainable. So it's, the project that we've been awarded for is called Pisces, and Pisces is a product that we've made. It's a light-emitting device that's really, really strong. It's really robust, and we can basically give it to fishermen to fit into their fishing gear, so the nets and the pots and traps. And we've found that light, if you put it in the right place and in the right frequencies and settings, you can attract and repel different species of ocean creatures. And this is useful because it means that when fishermen are actually out there using their fishing gear, they can more robustly, more reliably choose which species they want to keep in the nets and which species they want to scare away or allow to go free, which makes their fishing activities way more selective and much more manageable.
So to understand it correctly, you have this LED light device which you attach to the net, and then you throw it into the water?
Exactly, yeah. So these lights, they fit to the nets. They're very, very strong. They can go a kilometer under the water. And then when the lights turn on, they can attract different species, or they can scare them away and repel them based on that species and age and gender.
Could one say that you're actually communicating with the fish, with light?
Yeah, and in some ways. So what we've developed is this visual language, which means that we can selectively communicate between species. So let's say we have a blue light that we're shining out in a particular frequency that one type of species can see, like a haddock, for instance. But let's say a sole maybe can't see it so well, we can really selectively say to the haddock either, come closer or go away based on its behavior or response.
And the idea is to reduce the amount of bycatch.
Yep, so Pisces was designed entirely with the idea of reducing bycatch or wastage in the fishing industry.
Well, how big a problem is bycatch?
The bycatch problem is pretty massive. So it's changed a lot over the years, but the figures range from somewhere between like 8 and 25% of the global catch can be wasted due to non-selective fishing. And that's sort of billions of fish a year, or about sort of 20 plus million tons a year. So it's really significant.
And how much do you hope to reduce this by using this technology?
Some of the trials that we've done where Pisces has been used or other light-emitting devices have reduced bycatch by up to 90% in some fisheries. So that's sort of the high end. That's really like amazing to see. In some cases, it's between sort of 10% and 50%, or in that it's a whole spectrum. But in each case, we're able to reduce something, which is useful.
Well, I'm looking at the picture right now on your web on your website, and I'm thinking, well, this device, it seems it's very small, and it seems, well, cheap to produce, or is it cheap,
yeah,
or is it expensive, or what is it?
So we would say it's cheap. I mean, it is small, but it's very strong and it's sort of very easy to use. And one of the major factors that we've had to consider while designing this is that it's accessible, not only sort of in terms of usability, but also financially. There has to be a strong underlying business case for why anyone would buy our equipment. So we've had to price it and design it with the constraints of that pricing, so that we could actually make it affordable. And as such, if you look at the return on investment on using Pisces in particular fisheries, it's very, very fast. And that ties in with this sort of the accessibility side of things. So the devices themselves are not crazy, crazy expensive, and they unlock a lot more value than they cost to purchase.
And how many have you produced, and how do you expect to scale this project?
We've now produced, I mean, outside of the prototype versions, so we've now got the sort of this version one of Pisces, and we've produced a few hundred of those now that we've been using in trials all over the world for the last about 1.5 to 2 years. But this year, actually, we're scaling up our production after having just closed recently an investment round, a seed round, and we're scaling up the production into the thousands so that we can start supplying these kits to the trials where we've seen it has had some success. So in terms of actually commercializing, we're now going into the thousands.
How many will you produce, and how many fishermen will use this technology in like 5 years?
So we'd like to see a large portion of the fishing industry, the sector, actually using Pisces in the next 5 years. I mean, there's a lot of regulation coming in which really reinforces the need for technology like ours. And the price point, we think, fits very nicely and very appropriately within business models of a lot of fishing groups. So as a way of helping comply better with regulation and actually fish more sustainably, because everyone wants to avoid waste anyway, it's a very easy to fit solution. Which we hope will work well with the sector. So we think uptake is going to be pretty good as we identify more species that it works with, which is the real key here. We've got other ideas that we want to explore as a company. We're sort of looking at how we start moving into sort of the artisanal sector. So with the lower economic access, how do we start to make the science scale across the sort of 650,000 fishing vessels, for instance, in Indonesia, which have some impact on the environment, but the economic accessibility is lower there. And we're looking at other things like ocean monitoring and stuff. So quite a lot of interesting R&D going on.
How many species does it work with?
That's a really, really good question. So we have been working on this trial basis for, like I said, a few years now. And as these trials close, we learn more about the species it works with. What we're starting to do as a company this year is actually employ scientists in-house to start aggregating all of that data. So we've seen it applied to sort of 10 plus species, something like that, and seen the different responses of those. What we're hoping to do is look wider through the literature and start to find these trends about where it might work in the future to guide our research activities. But currently there's probably about 10 to 15 species that we've seen scientifically tested to see what their responses would be. The interesting thing is that, like, as the industry is increasingly regulated, and we're seeing these regulations implemented, and there's some tweaking to be done around things like the Common Fishery Policy. But all of the regulations are aiming to be based on scientific advice. So as with any tool, the tool is good, but it has to be used in a responsible way. So while our tool can do a particular thing, it needs to be used within like strong management frameworks and regulation that has been sort of figured out based on what the scientific limits of a stock are. Because I mean, if you don't have that in the first place, then, you know, of course things are going to go a bit awry. But essentially, if you know as a fishing crew that you're going out that you should be catching more cod because it's abundant and you should be avoiding the whiting in that area, then these tools will let you more effectively do that. But it has to come from scientific advice.
Okay. I can hear the seagulls in the background from where you're standing. Where are you going right now?
So I'm currently in the north of France. I'm in Boulogne-sur-Mer. We're visiting some fishermen on their fishing vessels, actually, in the port here. So I'm surrounded by seagulls. I can see about 20 fishing trawlers from here, actually, including the one that we're meeting, which is the Saint-Jacques. They'll be trialing our devices later this summer. So we're meeting them to discuss what they've found so far and what feedback they have and how we can add that to the design. And it's great to get their feedback.
Ja, og jeg linker til Pisces fra techtopia.dk, så du selv kan gå ind og se den smarte lille lysdiode, som de sender ned med fiskenettet. Det sidste vinderprojekt fra Index Award, som vi kommer forbi i dag, det handler ikke om mad, det handler om design af tøj. Fordi tøj og ikke mindst forbruget af vand i forbindelse med at producere tøj, er noget af det, der forurener og belaster klodens miljø allermest i dag. Det har det britiske designfirma Faber Futures besluttet sig for at gøre noget ved. Og det svar, de kommer op med, ja, det handler simpelthen om bakterier, som kan designe tøj. Måske ikke lige, hvilken størrelse du skal have på, men sådan mønstret og farven på de tekstiler, som din t-shirt eller din kjole skal laves af.
My name is Natsai Audrey Chiesa, and I am the founder and creative director of Faber Futures. Faber Futures is a company that operates at the intersection between nature and technology, and we are interested in shaping new models for sustainable futures. I founded the company in 2018 after about 8 years of research at the intersection of design and biology, a new field of design called biodesign, which really seeks to find new ways of manufacturing and thinking and doing that are based on how natural systems have evolved and work in tandem to create circular and sustainable environments. So what we are asking is, what can we learn from nature to do architecture better, to do design and fabrication better, and trying to establish the societal implications of emerging technologies that are coming into the into our toolkit, if you like. Specifically, synthetic biology that seeks to design and customize new living organisms that have specific capabilities. Can we work with nature to create green chemistry, for example? I was really interested in an organism called Streptomyces cilicola that produces a blue pigment molecule. And so coming in from a design background and looking at a bacteria that produces a pigment molecule, the question was, where does such an organism fit within our conceptualization of materials design and at different scales. It's pronounced cilicola, and cilicola means sky blue. This organism is called Streptomyces cilicola, and it is, you know, this beautiful blue pigment it's producing. It's actually an antibiotic. In science, it's very well characterized, the molecule within the realm of biomedical research, but looking at it from a design framework, we quickly understood that it could have efficacy somehow within design, and so through a series of different experiments, initially trying to extract the pigment to use it, you know, in existing methods of textile design like screen printing, we realized that actually what we needed to do was not to try to plug it into an existing system. What we needed to do was to think about it differently and allow its inherent biology to tell us what else it could do. And so a year into the project, we started to direct ferment this organism onto textiles, and that opened up an enormous world for us around how you could start to integrate fermentation with design processes to push the characteristics of the dye finishes, and doing it this way, and unlike you know, trying to extract a pigment and then dyeing it in the normal way, we quickly realized that we were using up to 500 times less water than you would ordinarily find in industry with particular fibers, and that we didn't need any chemistry, no sort of added chemical inputs to be able to fix that dye molecule onto the textile. And that's when I realized that not only was it an important question to ask, how do we integrate design thinking with science to push, you know, innovation, it was that doing this could actually open up new sustainable ways of manufacturing with biological matter.
I'm just curious here, because how do you actually control this process? I mean, how do you get a result that is sort of the desired result, a specific design or a specific color? And how do you actually scale it if you want to do like millions of t-shirts or dresses or whatever you do?
Those are really good questions. Our entire practice has been based on how do we drive, or at least create the conditions for very specific aesthetics to emerge. And that's when you start to have a design question that drives the scientific endeavor. We had to build new tools to be able to create prints that are very deliberate in their formation, which for a designer, you might ask, how do I make this particular print that I designed, you know, digitally on my computer? How do I translate that so that the bacteria create that print? The equivalent question in science is, how do you control the growth parameters of an organism? And so that is going to help you design what that toolkit is to be able to create a print. We also use, you know, very well-known biochemistry to be able to determine the growth conditions to drive particular shade of color to be produced. And so the question is, how do we, you know, for me as a designer, I want to know how I might be able to create a gradient print or gradient finish from dark blue to pink. The scientific question is, how do you control the pH of an environment where the bacteria is growing? So the push and pull between design and science is a beautiful one for us, because sometimes we are thinking very much with our collaborators about you know, what is known and what is tried and tested within the scientific realm. And other times we're coming up with, you know, quite new ideas that are driven from the, you know, by the perspective of cultural nuance that might be able to drive the science in a new direction. So it's both of those things sometimes at the same time. So one of the reasons why we've spent so much time trying to develop this work is to find all of the different ways in which you can actually introduce those pigment molecules onto a textile with the same kind of environmental efficacy that you find when you're doing it on a small little petri dish test, for example. And what we've created are a whole range of different protocols, again, integrating design and science, to be able to, you know, almost guarantee that you would get a particular aesthetic finish. I think we have about 12 different protocols for 12 different finishes right now. And each one of these protocols has different implications when it comes to this question of scale up. So we are working at the moment to take those protocols with different parts of the design, fashion, and textile industry to present it to existing brands who have different, if you like, scale frameworks, from, you know, apparel to luxury to couture, for example, to then say, this is the palette of techniques we've developed. How would you scale these within the context of the size and of scope of your production? But also, how would you scale these very defined design-led processes so that they speak to your brand and your positioning and your heritage and your customer? For us, that's where it becomes really interesting to think of biofabrication or the design of biology as being inherently tied to not just producing a chemical replacement for toxic dyes, but it's also an amazing creative space to connect with culture and society.
Could you sort of explain the workflow, I mean, from idea to a product?
So far, we haven't used any technologies that are part of the synthetic biology toolkit to produce this work. We are working with a naturally occurring phenomenon from a wild type organism. For it to scale, however, we will need to be able to tap into that toolkit. So you might want to do some strain improvement so that you have a more reliable model for the production of that pigment. So, you know, they're very specific tools that enable you to design the characteristics of that organism, anything from, you know, creating more than just a blue pigment. We might want to create a whole range of other pigments using this organism, since we are developing all of this other infrastructure around it. In essence, the organism becomes a platform, and then you're able to tweak it for it to be able to have different performance qualities. So I think that where we are at with our research is understanding the context in which these technologies could be deployed, as we are seeking to scale the technology. It is to understand the right interventions you might implement so that it is contextually appropriate for the partner you are scaling up with, or the brand you are scaling up with. What we are talking about is looking at the strains that we have that are existing, that we've bioprospected from the soil, for example, and we're saying, okay, this organism has evolved to be able to produce all sorts of different compounds and molecules, including you know, the pigment in that we're talking about. How do we edit this organism so that it can produce, instead of the blue, how do we take the gene that codes for that and perhaps replace it for a gene that codes for a brown pigment? So that's the kind of intervention you would see there. And what you would have at the end of it are these strains that have been calibrated to be able to fit within the context of dyeing perhaps a particular fiber at a particular rate for a specific in industry need, whether it's consumer-based or industrial-based textiles. And then where things are from our end is that we have a process by which we are fermenting this organism with the nutrients that it ordinarily requires to be able to go through its life cycle and to metabolize the sugars and et cetera, to then actuate the production of, or to induce the production of, the particular molecule in question. What we have experienced is that this can happen as a liquid fermentation, not too different to how you might brew yeast for beer. Or you do it through a solid state fermentation, which is, in very basic terms, you might grow it on a petri dish with agar. Once those bugs go through their life cycle, up to 7 days, we've tested for more of that because the color does change. Then it's a case of removing those cells from whatever substrate they've been growing on, or taking them out of a liquid fermenter and separating the pigment out of the liquid. And what you have at the end of it is either, a pigment patty or cake from the liquid fermentation process, which you would understand as an ingredient that you then add to another dye process or an existing dye process, or you have your textile that has had the bacterial biomass removed from it after the life cycle is complete, and all you have left there is the deposited pigment on the textile. So the question that we are asking when it comes to scale up is, which of the protocols that we've been developing are appropriate given the use case and given the nature of that particular brand and their considerations.
Jeg linker til projektet Silicolor fra tektopia.dk, og det var så det tredje og sidste vinderprojekt fra Index Award, vi fik plads til i den her udgave af Tektopia. Jeg håber at kunne vende tilbage med de sidste to af de i alt 5 prisvindere fra awarden på et senere tidspunkt. Og her til sidst, der skal vi også lige have et podkort fra podcasten Transformator.
En drone, der selv finder rundt på gigantiske møllevinger og undersøger dem for svagheder og fejl. En lyd, der fjerner andre lyde, f.eks. larmende kolleger. Og endelig opdræt af fisk i dambrug på land, nu da regeringen vil lukke de danske havbrug. I denne uges Transformator skal vi høre om praktiske teknologiske løsninger på kendte problemer, men vi skal også brokke os, og jeg kan sige så meget, at det går ud over teleselskaberne i denne uge.
De har jo klokket godt og grundigt rundt i det, fordi for det første, så har de ikke haft en valideringsmekanisme. Du tager nogle data og propper ind, så får du nogle andre data ud, og de har ikke valideret dem. Det er så én ting. Men når man ser på, hvordan de beskriver det, som de kalder teleselskabernes fejl, så får man et indtryk af, at politiet slet ikke er klar over, hvilke begrænsninger der er i data, og hvordan man benytter dem.
Du har lyttet til Tektopia. Jeg linker til nogle af de ting, vi har talt om her i podcasten fra vores hjemmeside, tektopia.dk. Du kan også skrive til mig på henrik@tektopia.dk. Du kan følge podcasten på Twitter, @tektopia.dk. Og du kan deltage i diskussionen i vores Facebook-gruppe, der er op mod 1500 medlemmer nu, som alle sammen diskuterer teknologi. Den hedder Tektopia Backstage, så det søger du bare på, og så kaster du dig ud i diskussionen om teknologi. Og så er der kun tilbage at sige på genhør, og husk nu at passe godt på vores allesammens blå planet. Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia. Tektopia.